This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy. Today we are joined by Timothy Wiley, author of a wonderful new book on the Process Church called Love, Sex, Fear, Death, The Inside Story of the Process Church of the Final Judgment. And that is put out by Feral House Books, and it is also available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Timothy, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Good to be here.
Now, Timothy, do you have a web page you'd like to give out? Because I know that you're also a very prominent writer on various metaphysical topics. Could you give out your web address for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much. www.timothywiley.com. That's W-Y-L-L-I-E.
TimothyWiley.com. Very good.
Now,
Timothy, this was really a fascinating book. This is one of these books that I absorbed. I've been interested in the Process Church for many, many years now, and there are a lot of misconceptions about it, which you address in the book. Now, to start with, you were one of the first people, the first person in the Process Church to know Robert Moore de Grimston. You knew him in college before he was even involved with metaphysical things. Is that correct?
Yes, that's perfectly true. Actually, there were about two or three of us who came from the same architectural college, but I was the one who kind of was closest to Robert, and also was the person who he called up, you know, to get involved in this new psychotherapy technique that they had evolved.
Now, they drew a lot of their sources, and by they, I mean Robert Moore de Grimston and his wife, Mary Ann, who passed away in 2005. Now, they drew heavily from the Church of Scientology. Is that correct?
No, I really would like to make this clear from the start.
Sure.
They attended Scientology for a period, I think, probably less than a year. But they were both extremely intelligent people, and they did find a way to use the E-meter in a much more effective way than Scientology was using it. And there were a couple of exercises, I think, from in the communication course, which had been taken from Scientology. But no, in fact, actually, if anything, we tried to push away any association we might have had with Scientology.
Very
different.
Right, and you wound up on L. Ron Hubbard's nasty list or something at one time. Is that right?
Yes, we did.
Oh,
yes,
my.
We did.
Now, it's quite interesting because this church movement, and I first encountered it in 1970-71 when I was with a family friend, Danny Schechter, and I was just a little kid then. Now, you proselytized quite a bit in your church after you founded it, and could you tell us a little bit about Process Church theology, because it's very different from other forms of Christianity, really?
Yes, it is. Actually, it's closer to, if kind of religious specialists are interested, it's closer to Gnosticism than it is to straight Christianity. And you have to also remember, Bill, that we started as a psychotherapy, and we were always very interested in the personality and the how to deal with and get rid of the things that block us from being successful and, to do what we want to in life. So we became a church after, I don't know, maybe 5 years of therapeutic work when we came to America. And the theology we evolved was very much a theology that emerged out of the work we had been doing with personalities. And this is very much Robert and Mary Ann's business. I actually was not that involved in the cosmology, creating the cosmology. But it was to do with the division into four different types of personality. You get the kind of strong, aggressive, authoritarian personality that we identified with Jehovah. You get the much more easygoing, more artistic, more sensitive personality, which is the Luciferic. You get the more fiery, passionate aspect of the personality, idea of identifying archetypes. And then, of course, as we became more churchified, these became more sort of dogmas, and Robert wrote a lot of books, which I have to say I was not particularly engaged with. I was much more involved in the visual stuff in the magazine.
Very good. Now, your movement, or the process movement, it spread from London and pretty much hit some of the major centers in Europe and the United States. At its height, how many members totally worldwide would you say? And I know you have different designations within the group, but on total with affiliates and such, how much would you say the movement actually reached?
Well, we used to exaggerate the figures, I'm sure, like everybody does. We used to say probably something like 100,000 people or something, but of course, we touched an enormous number of people, and our magazines, we had a print run of about 200,000, so the magazines went far and wide, far and all over the place, actually, in Europe and in America. But you have to remember that we made it incredibly hard to get in. It took at least 2 years to, prove that you were prepared to give up everything, and become celibate and, have no personal money and no personal choice and everything. So the actual inside group was never very large, never more than 100. But because we were so obsessed and dedicated, we were working 20 hours a day, we were much more effective than the numbers would pretend to be.
Now, you opened a lot of coffee houses and did a lot of social service type things. Could you tell us a little bit about how that operated? You ran soup kitchens and such for poor people?
Yes. We went through a number of stages over the 20 years or so in which the cult was burgeoning. And one period was very much involved in helping people both in the coffee houses, where we would be very open, we'd invite people in, and the sort of people who wouldn't be accepted anywhere we would happily accept. And we ran various different, as you said, soup kitchens. Our bands used to go out and play in prisons and in asylums and places like that. We were pretty dedicated to helping out people, but there was also a sort of self involvement as well. In a sense, one of the things about cults is that they keep you very busy, and because busy people don't have enough time to think, what on earth am I doing here? So a lot of that also was to do with having a chance to give people something to do and be helpful at the same time.
Now, you brought up the C word. I didn't. Cult. And I'm curious, did you consider this organization a cult in the destructive sense?
Well, back in the 60s and 70s, cult wasn't considered a bad word. And if you think about it, all a cult is the start of a religion. That's all it is. And I don't know exactly at what point a cult becomes a religion. You have to have 1 million members or 5 million members. I don't know, but it's just the start of something. And then over the years, because of these disasters at Jonestown and everything like that, of course, cults have had a bad name. But cults have been very valuable to many people because it allows one to step outside the norms of society and put oneself through experiences which one would never, ever, ever dream of having under normal circumstances. And that's a very powerful, it's a very powerful magnet, both for, small groups who work like that. And also, it's a very powerful bonding mechanism for people, and that's why cults become so, I think, so extreme very often. But this definition of cult is pretty straightforward. It's anything really that the followers of charismatic leaders. That's pretty much what a cult is. And so, yes, we were a cult.
Oh, very good. Now, on a few unpleasant topics which you cover in the book, I'll just say them. It's four words. Charles Manson and David Berkowitz. Could you comment on the many allegations that have been made about the connections between Manson and the Son of Sam serial killer?
Yes, indeed. Yes, these emerged from two writers who make their living by making up stories about other truth in any of this. We were never met Manson. It was perhaps an unfortunate coincidence that we happened to be living on a street in which Manson also had a house at some point. I'm not even sure we were there at the same time. We weren't in L.A. at that point. He's made up stories afterwards, but then, you know, who would believe Manson? And the Berkowitz thing is just even crazier. We happen to have German Shepherds. We love German Shepherds. I had one myself for 13 years. Kept my heart open. And so simply because we have German Shepherds, and German Shepherds turned up in the Berkowitz business, this pathetic creature of a writer, I'm not even going to mention his name, you know, makes the wonderful sort of associative, illogical jump that, you know, since we have German Shepherds and we've been written about so badly, you know, about the family business, that he could sort of put it off onto us. But it was just ridiculous. Just ridiculous.
Now, I will say this. David Berkowitz never claimed to be a member of the Process Church of the Final Judgment. He did claim to be a Satanist involved with Satanism, but that's not necessarily that it's a big jump to go from
enormous jump, Bill. We were never Satanists.
Right.
Satan was one of the personalities, the archetypes that we were examining. We weren't worshipping Satan, for goodness sake. We weren't worshipping any of them. You know, if you want to worship anybody, worship God, you know, not one of these archetypes.
Very good. I just wanted to point that out. And I know it's a very unpleasant topic. I certainly wouldn't want to be associated with two people like that in any way. And you clarify this in the book very well.
Right.
Now, what happened? What was the demise of the Process Church of the Final Judgment, which it rose up and pretty much fell apart quickly? From everything I've read about it, by 1975, it was pretty much the original church leadership was out or fragmented. Then there were some spin-off groups, and I would say, you may disagree with me, but roughly by 78, maybe the latest 1980, it was pretty much altogether gone or transformed into the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, a kind of secularized. What would you say about the decline of the Process Church?
Well, Bill, I can tell you pretty precisely because I lived through it.
You were there. Right.
Robert and Marianne split up, I think it was in 73 or 74, and Robert went off basically trying to get something going. It wasn't successful and went back into the secular life. Most of us, or at least all of us, stayed with Marianne through that period, but she was getting a little crazier by that point. And, you know, Robert was a modulating influence on her. And, you know, she became increasingly authoritarian, unreasonable. And by 1977, about, I would say, 15 or 20 of us decided to leave. And we went off in different directions. I went with about seven of others into a sort of situation where we basically deprogrammed ourselves over the next year. And by 1978, the end of 78, they left New York and, yes, began the slow change into what they've become now, which is the Best Friends, as you say. So it's all, you know, it looks very quick from the outside, but when you're on the inside, you can kind of see the incremental sort of changes that precipitated the downfall.
Now, I hate
the transformation, I should say. I didn't call it a downfall.
Right.
It was more of a transformation.
Now, I hate to bring this up again, but you just used the word deprogram. And that's very much in the, you know, the exit counseling from cults and stuff. Now, when Marianne became authoritative, did you feel compelled to follow her? Or there must have been some part of yourself, but as you said, this woman's getting a bit crazy, to use your own words. And did that help you get out of it? And what was that process of deprogramming? Because that's a word you brought up. I'm just curious.
Yes. Well, of course, you brought up a lot of issues here. I should add that in 1973, I had a very, very transcendent near-death experience, which I won't go into here because it's, you know, you'll read my book. But it really kind of opened my eyes to a deeper spiritual reality than the one that Marianne was presenting. So I was kind of starting to sort of move away. Now, the deprogramming thing, you know, when soldiers come back from wars, you know, they basically have to be deprogrammed on a physical level. But any cult in which there are hierarchies of membership, and there generally are in authoritarian cults, and there are secrets held between these various different levels of the hierarchy. So, you know, certain people know certain things, other people know other things. So when you actually get together, you start sharing these various different pieces of information. You can build up a picture which allows you to see the whole picture rather than just the particular picture you're being fed.
No, very good. Now, that's a very clear statement. Now, I actually became familiar with you after you left the Process Church, and when I first started to hear your name and read your books and such things, I at first didn't realize you were even in the Process Church of the Final Judgment. Could you tell us a bit about your metaphysical writing since then, which I may add are very interesting and very worthwhile? And I wasn't introduced to you through your book on the Process Church. It's your work with angels and angelology and such. Could you tell us a bit about these writings?
Yes, of course. Well, just to go back to the near-death experience, in my near-death experience, I spent time with angels. I saw angels. I was healed in a situation, you know, in which I saw these little guys that they talk about, these little gray guys. So when I got out of the process, you know, in a sense, I guess I was kind of getting ready for, you know, a new phase of life. I was 37, and I kind of bumped into dolphins in a strange way by seeing a couple of films, very short films taken by biologists about dolphins, which was quite clear to me that there's something telepathic going on, whereas it wasn't clear to the scientists, of course, because scientists don't believe in telepathy. But it's quite obvious watching the film that was telepathy was happening. So I got on the plane, went down to Florida, meditated on the beach in clear water, and got in contact with a pod of dolphins, coastal dolphins there, and they kind of inducted me into their pod, and that sort of led to that my first book, which was called Dolphins, ETs, and Angels, because we had a couple of extraterrestrial experiences which seemed to be somehow involved with the dolphins. And then out of the blue, some people up in Toronto had opened up and were speaking with angels, so we went up there and got involved with that. So that was that first book, and then that sort of, you know, opened up a whole channel of information for the angels, which led to my second book, which is Ask Your Angels, which I wrote with Alma Daniel and Andrew Raymer, which is basically a manual for helping people to get in contact with their angels, because it's so important right now that we align ourselves with our higher purpose. And basically, the angels are really wonderfully helpful in that, and also helpful in getting rid of the obstacles. And I just finished this third book, actually, in that particular series called Rising Angels. And there's another book called Adventures Among Spiritual Intelligences, and another book coming up next year called The Heliax Proposition. So I've been fairly busy, and I'm very thankful, actually, to the process that it allowed me to understand how hard one can work and how much pleasure and joy there is in creative work.
Now, you claim when you were in the process, you only used to sleep 4 hours a day and work 20?
Well, that was at a particular period when I was put in charge of a very difficult situation of raising an enormous amount of money, and I had a lot of people working under me, and I just had to keep them kind of fed with ideas. So, yeah, I mean, that's what killed me. I worked myself to death.
You're not working those hours now, I
think. No. I now sleep 5 or 6 hours.
Oh, very good. Very good. Now, what are your plans for the future? I know you have a book coming out next year, but you're going to continue on in this metaphysical genre?
Yes, I mean, that's really my love. I'm also a visual artist as well, so I kind of interplay those two aspects. If anybody goes into my site, you'll see the kind of the artwork that I do, which is also metaphysical. You know, I try and meditate and create, you know, write or paint at the same time, draw at the same time. I'm actually looking at this 2012 business really quite seriously. There's an awful lot of
Maybe they'll sell well in 2013, hopefully. Maybe. Well, that was very good. And I want to point out your visual art is quite stunning. And I have a fairly large collection of the old Process magazines, which I've collected over the years. And you did a lot of graphics for those as well. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. No, I was the art director.
You were the art director. And this
art
is
director, and I did most of the graphics, yeah.
It's quite stunning, especially for that time before they had all this, you know, computer animation and all this wonderful stuff. The things you did then were quite wonderful. And as I say, I guess now you look back at it, it was very limited technology.
Well, yes. I mean, anybody who, has a hand in artwork will be amused at the idea of cutting different acetate sheets in order to do four-color separations. Creating the four-color separations ourselves now sounds mad with Photoshop.
That's a Stone Age stuff.
You know, 2 weeks to do double-page spread.
That's Stone Age technology these days.
Well, we thought, of course, it was very advanced, but... Stone Age.
Quite wonderful. And I suggest, I just want to give out your web address once more. It's timothywiley.com, timothywiley.com, and that's why don't you spell it so I don't mix it up?
All right, so anyway, yeah, just one word, TimothyWiley.com.
TimothyWiley.com. And again, I highly recommend this book on the Process Church, Love, Sex, Fear, Death, The Inside Story of the Process Church of the Final Judgment by Timothy Wiley, and it's put out by Ferrell House. I love Ferrell House's books. They do such a great job with everything they work with, and I really commend them for bringing this book out on the Process Church, which really needed to be written, because with the internet, there's a lot of misconceptions, and I admit I had a lot of misconceptions about the Process Church before I read your book, Timothy, and you clarified a lot of it, and, you know, you were very balanced. You saw what was good and what was bad about the church, and I admire that greatly. And, you know, you didn't unfairly attack anyone. And that was a wonderful thing to do, because a lot of people who come out of these kind of groups have hard feelings, but you kind of put them all in perspective. And again, I really highly recommend it. And we're about out of time, and I'd like to thank you for coming on Sphinx Radio, and I'd like to invite you back sometime. We'll talk about your angel books.
I'd love to do that, Bill. Thanks so much. Wonderful questions, and I really appreciate the fact that you saw that the real inside story of the process is far more interesting than all that ridiculous, malicious lies.
The fiction, and, I'll even admit I have said nasty things about the Process Church in the past, and I take them back after I've read your book. I was misinformed by some of these other writers, and now I get the full picture, and I thank you for that, and we'll have you back again. Thank you, Timothy.
Thanks so much. You're redeemed.
Oh, thank you.